In today's episode of Backpacker Radio, the Cinnamon Connection catches up with Bill Manning, the executive director at the Colorado Trail Foundation. We do a deep dive on all things Colorado Trail related, including the best time to hike the trail, the biggest mistake aspiring thru-hikers make, and the inner workings for keeping such a beautiful trail afloat. Chance lets us in on a mega surprise, and we cover the most popular sleeping bags used on the AT last year. But first, if you've listened to Backpacker Radio, you know that both Chance and I are big fans of Gossamer Gear, manufacturers of lightweight backpacking gear and accessories. Their packs carry comfortably, their roomy shelters protect in harsh weather conditions, and the trekking poles are some of the lightest on the planet. Gossamer Gear is changing the perception of delicate, ultralight gear. Chance and I are both very familiar with Gossamer Gear's products. I use the Gorilla, their 40-liter pack, on the PCT in 2017. I've also used the Mariposa for probably about 1,000 miles. Chance used Gossamer Gear's The One Shelter. It's the one you need, after all. Also, to celebrate being in business for 20 years, Gossamer Gear recently put together an awesome short video highlighting their history. It's certainly worth checking out, and we will, of course, link to it in the show notes. Listeners of this podcast can score an exclusive deal on Gossamer Gear products. Use discount code TREK15 for 15% off your cart at gossamergear.com, which is valid for a limited time only. Get some. And also, we want to give a shout out to Sawyer Products. Today, I want to re-remind you guys about their permethrin fabric treatment, which is highly effective against deer ticks. If you're going to be hiking in areas with a lot of deer ticks, such as the Mid-Atlantic states, New England, or the Northwoods of Wisconsin, for instance, you'll want to pay attention because Lyme disease is a motherfucker. Sawyer's permethrin treatment is an odorless after-drying fabric treatment that does not harm any fabrics or finishes. It repels and kills mosquitoes and ticks for 6 weeks or 6 washes. It can be used to treat clothing, footwear, workwear, bibs, canvases, workstations, seat covers, dog beds, hammocks, chairs, tents, camping gear, mosquito netting, nets, outside of sleeping bags, backpacks, ground cloths, and other fabrics. Hang up clothes or gear, apply enough spray to allow color change in fabric, allow to dry for 2 hours before use to maximize the insect repellent's effectiveness and longevity, 4 hours for very humid locations. Lastly, it can be applied directly to dogs for protection from mosquitoes and fleas for 35 days and from ticks for 6 weeks. Official application instructions at sawyer.com/dogs. You can find Sawyer's permethrin fabric treatment at your local outfitter, REI, or Sawyer.com. Okay, let's do this thing. Presented by the Trek. This is episode number 27. Do we have a 27 theme? Do we stop doing themes?
I'll be 27 in March.
That's weird. I'm going to be 27 in March.
That's not true.
Oh, yeah, no. I was 27, 27 years ago. Oh, that's pretty exciting. So today's the Chance birthday theme show. I am your co-host, Zach Badger Davis, and to my right standing...
Hello, I'm Juliana Chauncey, a.k.a. Chance.
How do you feel about the standing situation?
It's a bit different.
Yeah. It'll keep the blood circulating to our brains and we'll sound a little bit less stupid, even though I did just say blood.
Yeah.
Ignore that part.
We're testing out a standing desk today and it's doing a number on us.
Yeah. We're going to walk away with phenomenal posture. So before we get into our interview with Bill Manning, who was awesome, the executive director at the Colorado Trail Foundation, we need a little drum roll here. Chance has got an exciting announcement to make. We were going to save this for the end of the episode, but we spilled the beans in the interview, so we have to go with it up front. So what's the announcement?
I am...
Pregnant.
Pregnant. I'm just kidding. I am hiking the AT this year.
Woo! Holy shit. Okay, so you've been stewing on this idea for quite some time. People that have been listening to this are already aware of that. What was the final straw?
I think just figuring out the logistics of it. We're going to keep podcasting. I'm going to go hike. Everything's happy and fun and sunshiny and rainbowy.
A little inside baseball. Chance gave me a very professional PowerPoint presentation on the reasons why she should A, both be able to hike the AT, and B, still maintain the co-host position of the show. So good news for all the Chaunce fans, bad news for all the Chaunce haters. But But Chaunce will still be co-hosting as she gallivants north along the Appalachian Trail. Okay, so one of the things that we prepared for this announcement was you were going to bring a couple of your noob AT questions.
Yeah, because you think you know things after you've done some hiking.
Yeah.
But there are so many things that I realize I don't know that like are AT specific.
Well, lucky you. I don't know if you know this, but I actually hiked the AT in 2011.
I'm going to trust you on that one. Okay. I'm not sure if you're telling me the truth or not, but I'll trust you. So my first question is, what do I need to do before day one on trail? Like, I heard something about a permit, even though it's not like the PCT type permit.
Yeah.
I heard something about the approach trail, a check-in, an AT tag.
These are good questions. So the voluntary AT, like through hiker registration thing, is actually new since I hiked. So I only know of it from what I've read on the trek. But it is voluntary. They do that primarily to encourage you to spread out your start date away from the masses. So unlike the PCT, they don't actually cap it. This is more purely informational. And that's the extent of my knowledge. So the other question I heard there was the approach trail or to not approach trail. Just depends. So there are certain people out there that say that if you haven't hiked the approach trail, you haven't hiked the AT, like you haven't actually done a full through hike. I think they're just being assholes. Like they're ultra purists, or they're just, you know, making jokes because they did that and that's the way that people should follow suit. I personally did not. The thing with not hiking the approach trail is there's a parking lot about one trail mile north of Springer Mountain, but it is a major pain in the ass to get to. So you have to have a connection in the Atlanta area willing to make that ridiculous, like, dirt road drive for you. I've heard it's a really pretty hike. There's a lot of steps. It's challenging. I think it's a difficult 8 miles to what's the opposite of ease you into a long through hike. But yeah, so if you want to put all those naysayers at bay, I would say do the approach trail. If you don't care and you just want to do all the miles of the trail itself, find that parking lot 1 mile north.
So is that...
And then you backtrack to Springer Mountain, obviously.
Is there not... Because Ballflap didn't do the approach trail either, but he mentioned there was something about, like, at the start of their approach trail, like, you get this AT tag or something?
Yeah, so again, that's new since I hiked also, but I would still, regardless whether you do the approach trail or not, I definitely recommend that you stop at Amicalola Falls, because that gets your name into, like, the official ATC stat-keeping thing. That you sign in there, give them your name, your start date, and I think you get like a number, and Chaunce is legitimately taking notes right now. I'm glad this is a useful session. So you sign in, apparently you get your tag, and yeah, that just goes into the like the through hiker stats that the ATC keeps each year.
I see. Okay, my next question is, how do I get there? How does one get to the Southern Terminus?
Yeah, so I think probably the most common thing is people have friends, family, connections of some sort that are willing to make that drive. If memory serves, and don't quote me on this, I should know better, but I think it's about a mile and a half from Atlanta, from the airport. Or a mile and a half, hour and a half. It's a drive.
So would I fly into Atlanta?
Atlanta would be your closest airport. The guy that I started the trail with, his uncle lived in the area, and he gave us a ride. But one easy route, this is kind of like the Scout and Frodo version of the AT, is there's a hostel that will do this. Unlike Scout and Frodo, it's not free. And I don't know if they pick you up from the airport. I think it changed ownership recently. At least they go by a different name. I'll have to include it in the show notes because I actually don't remember the new name of the hostel. It used to be the Hiker Hostel. But I do think, now that I'm thinking about it, they offer shuttle service from the airport and includes a night stay at their hostel, and then they give you transportation to the start of the trail. So that's probably the easiest route if you don't know anyone in the area.
What about the Greyhound?
I doubt
a Greyhound.
Oh, is there a Greyhound option?
Yeah, Ballflap said he took a Greyhound, and then I saw on the AT like Facebook page a lot of people talking about a Greyhound.
Oh, this I am not aware of. I think that because our situation was handled so easily that I didn't really research it. Truth be told, I didn't research much about the AT.
It's been a while, altogether. Hasn't it?
Yeah, I know. I got to dust all the cobwebs off in the AT portion of my brain 2011 drink. But maybe there's a Greyhound. I'll have to look into that.
Okay. Next question. is that Bufflap told me to bring, because I was telling him that I might get the Montbell hoodie, or not hoodie, zip up instead of the Ghost Whisperer, because mine like has taken a huge beating.
Yeah.
And he recommends taking a fleece over a puffy. Hmm. Is that stupid?
Stupid? I don't, So I wonder why he suggests that.
Because it's always wet. The puffy will wet and not be warm, but the fleece will stay warm.
Right. So down does have trouble in obviously like damp environments. That's one, I think, misconception about down is it's not about like dropping it in a lake on accident or sweating through it. Although both of those things are not something that you should recommend for while you're using down. It's more so how humid the environment is. That being said, I still think as an insulating layer, down dominates on the Appalachian Trail, despite the humid environment. The one thing you could look into is either treating it with some sort of like hydrophobic treatment, which makes it more water resistant, or you can buy any number of down jackets that are treated by like DownTech, or there's a few competitors that do the same thing. But basically, it's just like a hydrophobic treatment that makes it a little bit more resistant to water. The thing about down is it's a much more efficient weight per or warmth per weight ratio. So, you know, the nerds who are counting grams, and that's one of those things where I think down makes the most sense. I would definitely encourage you to strongly consider down. That being said, I actually used a heavy wool layer on the AT based on a recommendation I had gotten. I think if I were to do it again, though, I would use down.
Okay, because I was thinking I might just bring both and then mail home whichever one I decide I don't want when I'm there.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the thing you could do to, if you do choose to go down, is when you're in town, maybe 2, 3, 4 times along the trail, is just to wash it with like down tech along the way, the down wash. That will preserve the loft. So if it does get a little bit wet, you can restore it 100% using this, or maybe not 100%, but pretty darn close using one of these wash treatments.
Okay, that answers that. The next one is, it has sub questions, but the first blanket one, actually, So the question is, can I use my food bag as a pillow like I've done on the Colorado Trail and the PCT? And I know that people don't like when you do that.
Right.
But is that what people do, or do they really not do that?
So, you know, if I were someone affiliated with the ATC or that had legal liability, and I guess by the fact that I'm putting this out in the public sphere, I do, the answer would absolutely be hang your food every single night.
Okay.
That being said, the only thing I will say is that a lot of hikers don't, especially I think probably the more experienced hikers don't. The thing about that is you have to be ultra picky about your campsite, which can be really difficult on the AT, especially in the bubble season.
If you are, or if you aren't hanging your food?
If you are not hanging your food, you have to be very picky about where you camp. So you don't want to camp near established campsites or areas where there is known bear activity. If you've got your food in your tent in an area where there's known bear activity, you're taking too big of a risk.
But what if people are sleeping in shelters? Do they not just like have the food in the shelter, or do they still go out to a tree and hang it up?
So I think probably now most of the shelters, especially in the South, probably have some sort of bear cables or something like that. Some sort of food storage option. I know there are, shelters once you get a little bit further north. And again, my memory is rusty. So if there's someone that hiked the trail last year is probably screaming at the radio right now.
Send me a DM.
Yeah. But there are places inside the shelter where you can hang your food. It's more so to protect against mice. Mice are the much bigger issue compared to bears. They will, they are very prominent on the AT, and they will chew through your food bag.
Yeah. So Bufflap told me that I needed to learn how to bear hang, which is one thing on the to-do list. And then my second question is, do I need a ursac? I don't know how you say that word.
So the ATC official recommendation now is, I don't know if it's the full distance of the trail or from, Springer, basically the southern terminus all the way to, I think, Damascus. I forget which one of the two recommendations it is. Either way, that's a significant amount of trail. They do recommend having some sort of bear storage something. So whether that's a bear canister, I think that's the thing that they push for, because it's the most foolproof.
Oh, is the ursac not for mice?
Ursac also works for mice, but it's, so I think the primary thing that the ursac is used for is for protection against from bears.
Oh.
So there's videos on their website of like grizzlies being unable to bite through this thing, which is freaky considering how light it actually is. It's a very tough material. For mice, the thing that you want to look into is an opsac.
Opsac.
Yeah, you can get this at REI. Any like common outfitter will carry this, but it's basically just a giant Ziploc bag. And I use this for the duration of the PCT. That's much more effective. So it's totally odor proof.
Basically. So is that what you use as your food bag then?
Sometimes you'll put the OPSAC inside of a different bag so you can actually hang it. So this is basically picture a giant long Ziploc bag.
Okay.
You can't hang it because there's no like loop function. There's no way to tie a rope in it into it. So if you wanted to use that with a food bag.
I could put that in like my Z-Packs food bag.
Exactly.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. That was my four questions.
Cool.
There'll be more. Don't worry.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because we've talked so much about the AT, but now it's got a very different level of interest for you.
I know. Now it's like, okay, but what do I actually need to do?
Yeah. You know, like the PCT, you'll find that all this stuff is super easy once you get out there. But yeah
I bet.
It's good to cover your bases definitely beforehand. Okay, so let's get into today's interview. Definitely had a lot of fun with Bill. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate his time, and here it is. Okay, we are here with Bill Manning, the executive director at the Colorado Trail Foundation. First and foremost, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Great opportunity.
Yeah, I hope so. So if you could start off, just tell us a little bit about your backpacking experience and how did you first, or have you hiked all of the Colorado Trail?
I've been on every inch. I've done it hike, bike, and horse.
Have you done all three, the full distance?
No, I haven't. I've done every inch, but on one of those three.
Got you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and that means you've done both the trekking route and the bike route.
Yeah, and it's important to me to see it from all different angles.
And if you could touch briefly on, this isn't even something I wrote down, but the difference between the cycling route and the hiking route. I think people that aren't too familiar with the trail might just assume that that's the same thing.
Well, cyclists are allowed on about 80% of the trail, and the portion that they are not allowed on, because it travels through designated wilderness, there are detours around those wilderness areas, most of them on gravel roads, and they're pretty scenic, but completely different character than the single track trail. And the cyclists ride around each wilderness area. The route is 540 miles, roughly, instead of 485.
Did you like biking or horseback riding or hiking it better than one of the others?
No, they were all super fun. I'd go back in a heartbeat and do any of those three on any portions I could.
Yeah. It's interesting because there was like I heard bits and pieces of little rifts between hikers and mountain bikers on the trail. Did you ever witness any of that?
Oh, sure. Certainly there's people get grouchy with one another at times, but I think that more than that, we have people getting along.
Yeah.
They're all just enjoying themselves out there, and as long as somebody doesn't spook a horse or scare the daylights out of some hiker or that kind of thing, then it all works out pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, every mountain biker I saw was pretty friendly.
Yeah. The year that I hiked, we crossed paths with a unicyclist. I think you must be familiar with this guy.
Yeah, I heard about him and saw some photos.
Uh-huh. That's an ambitious way to do that trail.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how did you first get involved with the Colorado Trail Foundation?
Well, I was running a different trail organization in Durango, Trails 2000. I was the executive director and the trail boss, all in one. And I got involved with the Colorado Trail as a volunteer, as an adopter of part of the Colorado Trail on behalf of this other group. And every year we'd go work really hard on a piece of trail from a Champion Venture Mine Road to Goody's Rest was our 15-mile piece. And a tough piece to handle, but we gave it our all every year and really got invested. Then I accepted a position on the board of directors of the Colorado Trail Foundation, and then they were in a frame of mind to hire their first ever executive director, and long story short, hired me. So I moved from Durango to Golden to run the Colorado Trail Foundation, and it's that was 13 years ago.
Oh.
Had you done most of the Colorado Trail at that point?
No, I was lacking about 350 miles. Mm-hmm. And so I started picking it up, doing pieces on week-long backpacking trips mostly, and some day hikes too, filling in. I made the spreadsheet from hell. It was really... my engineering girlfriend made me do a spreadsheet, and it actually helped me fill in the blanks.
So what do your responsibilities as the executive director look like?
Well, there's just two of us in the office, so we have to get everything done between the two of us. We both have to be really versatile. There's a lot of marketing involved. There's newsletters. There's communicating through Facebook. There are fundraising pleas. There are relations with the board of directors. And, boy, you name it. Plus, assembling the volunteers, we work really hard at enlisting folks to volunteer and do trail work. And that's the heart of our mission right there.
Talking about the trail work, you list two different opportunities to get involved with the website on, or to get involved with the trail on the website, rather. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference between the work crews and the Adopt-A-Trail?
Sure. Yeah. Adopters are the sort of the first line of trail workers. They go out on their own schedule, typically, after the snow melts in the spring, say mid-June and late June and early July, and they work on their piece and cut the trees apart that have fallen over. Seems like it's about 500 trees fall over across the Colorado Trail every season. After we have them cut 500 trees, then we have them dig the silt and debris.
Sorry to interrupt. Is this non-motorized cutting up of the trees? Can you use chainsaws, or does it have to be? Because I know in some areas, like on the PCT, I think people only use handsaws. Because I'm not sure if it's a logistical issue of getting a chainsaw that far into the backcountry, or if there's some sort of like wilderness regulation that prevents it.
Yes, is the answer.
Okay.
In wilderness, you can't use a chainsaw. Uh-huh.
I never knew that.
And then outside of wilderness, it's legal, but not everybody wants to. Mm-hmm. They're finicky and they're heavy and. There's other ways to go about it. So some choose to use chainsaws and others don't. And no matter what style of saw they use, it's really fun cutting the trees apart. And it's a bit of a safety hazard, too. You got to be careful with this work because the wood is heavy and it can hurt you. But the adopters do that type of work, and then they also dig the water bars clean so that the runoff diverts off the trail and doesn't erode it anymore. And then they report back to us, and those adopter reports are utilized to figure out the trail crew schedule for the following year, which places need the most work. So that's how we decide that. Our operations guy, Brent, who lives in Salida, he goes out on reconnaissance walks and walks the pieces that the adopters are saying are in bad shape, and then makes decisions and coordinates with the Forest Service to figure out where the next year's trail crews are going to be. So trail crews are more focused efforts than adoptions, and they are group things, big group things sometimes, from 10, 15 volunteers up to 25 or 30 volunteers on a trail crew, camping together, eating together, and working the trail together in one place where it's needy.
Mm-hmm. I saw on one of the brochures that I had gotten in the mail that some of them cost money. How come some of them cost a price to take part in?
Good question.
Well, we always charge volunteers to be on a trail crew with us. And that's because we have a lot of expenses. And some of it is food, but not food alone. There's equipment and trailers and transportation costs. And there's enlistment and brochures and mailings. And so we don't recoup all of our costs with the trail crew registrant fees. but we have everybody pitch in. And it actually gives people a good reason not to cancel. Mm-hmm. Huh. Once they have some money on the table, then they're much less likely to cancel. They come with us and have a great time, and everybody's the better for it.
Nice. And I saw that there were, you have single day opportunities and multi-day trips, correct?
Yes, we have a whole range, some single day and some up to a week long. And so really something for everybody.
What kind of skills does someone need going into one of these? Like, can they just be, you know, someone that's never participated in any sort of trail maintenance work in the past, or should they be experienced trail maintainers? What are you looking for?
No experience required.
Okay.
We ask that people be reasonably fit and reasonably ready for the elevations that, we're going to be working at. And we publish the elevation on the Trail Crew brochure so people can assess that for themselves. We'll train you. It is not rocket science. It's mostly like landscaping type work with hand tools, digging in the dirt, moving the dirt around to create water diversions. So that to limit erosion, the trail erosion, if it goes too far, you end up with a gully full of rocks, and nobody likes hiking or biking through a gully full of rocks. So we try our best to divert the water and keep our trail soil in place. And it's really a lot of fun. You can see the results of your work when you're out there, and you know, you're making new friends, and you're eating with one another, and at the dinner table, you're typically, you know, telling stories and getting to know other people's lives. It's a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the misconceptions people have might be that you have to, like, have some type of super strength or ability to lift these heavy rocks or boulders or
right.
move logs. And it's great to know that there are tasks that you can do on trail in helping to maintain it that don't have to do with heavy lifting.
Yeah. And I can reiterate, I've done some trail work on the AT, and it was a really good time for all the reasons that you listed. It's nice to get some exercise and see some progress of something that you've built throughout the day. I think a lot of us, you know, who work behind a desk, we push numbers around on a spreadsheet or whatever it might be, and you don't get that sense of satisfaction that you do where you actually can witness the evolution of something that you've built over the course of a day.
Absolutely. People really enjoy it. It's one of the best things that you can do with a group of volunteers is assemble and go work on a trail somewhere.
Yeah.
It's just a good fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the biggest challenges that the Colorado Trail currently faces?
Well, just sustaining the effort is the biggest challenge. I mean, we need money every year to keep the effort going. And we need volunteers every year. And typically our trail crews are... they approach being full, but we almost always have a few more slots that don't get filled, and we could sure use a few more volunteers for those slots. If we had a few more volunteers here and there, we'd get more work done, and we'd be able to keep the trail in just that much better condition.
Mm-hmm.
Although the Colorado Trail has got a reputation for being a very well-maintained trail. So we're really proud of our work, and, mm-hmm. and we've had enough help to date to keep this all going.
Yeah. I was shocked this summer on it how few parts of the trail I found myself getting frustrated on. There was, I think, maybe one small stretch where there was dirt bikes allowed as well. But other than that part, I can't think of a single part where I thought, wow, this trail... is rough.
Yeah.
It was beautifully maintained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very well done,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
We, in the Cochetopa Hills, is segments 17 and 18, we've got quite a few miles, actually, that need work pretty bad. And our strategy there is to try to get the green light from the Forest Service to reroute.
Oh.
Put the trail in
off
a different place.
No more dirt roads?
Well, our hope is to get off the dirt roads, and also our hope is to find a route that can be non-motorized.
Hmm. Oh.
So that's an ongoing effort since inception. We've hoped to put together an end-to-end non-motorized trail. But we're still working on it.
Yeah.
That would be really
great. That was my least favorite section.
Yeah.
As a ginger, that's a lot of sun exposure, and I was ill-equipped for that section.
As another ginger, Zach told me about the Cochetopa section, but he didn't tell me anything about it. He just talked about the Cochetopa section a lot. So as we approached it, I was all excited. I was like, yes, we're getting the Cochetopa section. Yeah. And then it was all dirt roads.
I'm glad you could fall into my own track, so to speak. Yep. So you mentioned the Adopt-A-Trail previously. Are there any segments of the trail that are currently unadopted?
I think we have one section open, or maybe two, and every year we have between 6 and 8 that come open because of the retirement of a previous adopter, or somebody moves away, or so that kind of thing. And we have a waiting list, and Brent Adams, our operations guy, keeps the names and contact info of people who want to be on the waiting list, and communicates with them when a section comes open, see if they want to take it on. It works really well. We're able to keep that program going since 1988.
Oh, wow. So how would someone go about getting involved as a volunteer?
Communicate with the Colorado Trail Foundation, ctf@coloradotrail.org. And if you forget that, just go to our website, coloradotrail.org, and look for the Contact Us information.
Nice.
What does the demographic of your current volunteer look like, if it doesn't span the spectrum?
Well, it does span the spectrum of ages and genders and you name it. We have always had the predominant the age average of our volunteers somewhere around retirement age. And that's because people at that time in their lives have more time on in their schedule.
Yeah.
But we have volunteers from 16 years old all the way up to 66, 76 years old working with us. And everybody works just as hard as they want to. We always encourage folks not to go overboard with their own efforts. So people make their own decisions, and everybody contributes a ton, and the numbers really are what makes it all work.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned during a previous conversation we had off mic about your desire to get more young people as volunteers out on the trail. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, that would help us a lot. You know, young folks have young muscles and lots of enthusiasm, and when we get young people to come out with us, which we do, but we'd love to have a few more. It works out really well. Great enjoyment on everybody's part. And the young folks oftentimes come back with us year after year. They've had so much fun. So, yeah, it's part of it's awareness building, because not everybody realizes that that a trail was constructed. I mean, some people think it just got walked in, but that's almost never the case. Somebody built the trail, somebody maintains the trail, and we need your help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. We should go out there next summer. Let's get a little crew together.
Aren't you going to be doing something?
Well, let's go at the end of next summer.
I guess people will know at this point. Chance is hiking the Appalachian Trail next year.
Oh, how cool. Yeah. How very cool.
Yeah, I'm excited.
All right.
Yep. I'll be around, so I'll definitely
exactly
be out
here.
There. But I don't know if I qualify as a young person anymore.
No.
I feel like...
Sorry, you're in that older tier.
Yeah.
Near retirement?
Jenna found a couple of grays in my beard recently, so...
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I don't know if I fit the demographic that you're looking for, but I'll be out there regardless.
If your beard goes gray first, I'm going to laugh so hard.
That's why I wear a hat. You don't know what's going on up top. I need a beard hat.
Patent pending.
Yeah. So what is the most common mistake you see from... you know, new people getting into backpacking who want to through hike the Colorado Trail?
Oh, they haven't trained hard enough.
Physically.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Part of that is their muscles, legs and a butt and back. But part of it is the skin on their feet. You need to get your your feet ready for to fend off the blisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's pretty serious out there. I think blisters end more trips than anything. They can get really troublesome and painful. Mm-hmm. So, and you know that.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I do.
So anyway, you want to do a lot of hiking in your lead up for your training, and you want to really pay attention to your footwear, both your shoes and your socks, how it fits, and look for that combination that's giving you no blisters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's tough to find too, because you can go out on 15-mile day hikes and be totally fine. This is what happened to me when mm-hmm. I was training for the Pacific Crest Trail a couple of years ago. Is I wore Ultra Olympus and I was doing 15 miles, between 10 and 15 miles a day, every single day on foot with those shoes. Never had a problem. Got out onto the PCT within 3 or 4 days. My feet were just covered in blisters. Yeah. So yeah, I think like a section hike, a shakedown hike is crucial to really figuring out your gear.
It helps.
Yeah.
Do you see a lot of people having problems with altitude since there's a lot of higher elevation spots on the trail?
Some, but there's increasingly there's a good sharing of information about altitude. There's a Facebook page that's really excellent. It's a closed group, so you have to join it to see the content. But it's a altitude acclimatization page. And excellent information. One of the most important findings is about staying hydrated. Hydrate before you come, a couple of days at minimum. Stay hydrated in the first part of your trip, actually through your whole trip. Hydrating really helps your body make more red blood cells, and it needs those at altitude. So but there's other things too. There's a drug that people take for high altitudes, and they can go talk to their doctors about that. It's really pretty effective, but some of the side effects aren't so great. Anyway, personal choice. But we always recommend, if you're having trouble, go to a lower elevation rapidly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's another good case point for hiking. Do you consider it southbound or westbound?
Oh yeah, we were debating that.
Yeah,
we always say southbound.
Southbound,
but that's only because of the other long trails in the U.S. are north south,
yeah,
predominantly. Anyway,
yeah, we had been calling it Wobo for a while.
Wobo,
we're yeah. going Wobo
or Swobo,
Swobo,
yeah, and Swebo.
Yeah, yeah, that's another good reason to do the Denver to Durango route, because you definitely acclimate much more slowly as opposed to, we did the majority of the trail the other way. You start at Durango and you get up to 10,000-12,000 feet quickly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So
yeah, and then you stay up at 12.
Yeah, yeah. That stretch between Lake City and Silverton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's backcountry. You're deep into the backcountry. It's not easy to extricate yourself.
Right.
So that's it is better in that way to start in Denver. A lot better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And much easier too. Those first 100 or so miles are pretty cake, aside from the elevation.
You don't get any terrible climbs really until segment 7.
Yeah.
Once you're coming out of Copper.
That's right.
That one's a treat. So how has the trail changed since you've been involved with the CTF?
Oh my gosh, the trail itself has gotten way better maintained in the last 13 years. We've refined our systems, and part of that is the information sharing between adopters and our trail crew people. Our information sharing has gotten better, and so we've been able to work on the pieces that need more work more effectively. So we've upgraded a lot of the trail. We've added, in that time, we've added 80 miles. The Collegiate West has become part of the Colorado Trail, and that wasn't the case beforehand. We've put in place the Cataract Ridge reroute, which before you walked it, segment 23, didn't go where it goes now. Mm. It was on motorcycle trail and roads. And now it is on probably one of the prettiest segments of all. Stays up high, real pretty single track. But you pay for it, don't you? A lot of rollers at 12,000 feet.
Yeah.
A lot of 500-foot climbs.
But they also say that Cataract Lake's one of the best spots to see a moose on trail.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a win.
Yeah, for sure.
And over that time span, how have the hikers changed, if at all?
Well, many more out-of-state visitors, that's for sure. The Colorado Trail is becoming more well-known. And part of that is people that have been from out of state, have hiked the Colorado Trail, enjoyed it so much that they've gone back to their hiking club and talked it up. Mm-hmm. And there's been a whole bunch of that. There's been a few books put out and lots of blogs, mm-hmm. and photo sharing. Mm-hmm. So the word's just spreading, and that's a good thing. So more out of state and more out of country mm-hmm. visitors.
I feel like she's underappreciated, and to be perfectly honest, I've only just barely scratched the surface learning about her history. Can you tell us a little bit about Goody Gaskill? Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, you did. Goody, she passed away 2 years ago, but she was a key person in the history of the Colorado Trail. This was not an easy trail to get constructed or even approved for construction. And Goody was the one that just embraced the idea and hung on to it and just absolutely bulldogged it to the point where we ended up with a connected Colorado Trail, 467 miles long to start out with, I think. Now it's 485, so we've lengthened it here and there and put it in different places. Goody was a key volunteer. Volunteer all those years she worked on it, always volunteer.
How had she formed such a strong connection to the trail that she pushed so hard to get it to be made?
Well, the sense of investment. She just, she got started on it and just wouldn't give it up. She led trail crews. She cooked for trail crews. She barked at people. She went to the U.S. Forest Service, and when some male forester told her no, she said, "Well, I'm going to go talk to the governor of Colorado and see if he'll give you a phone call." That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And she just pushed and pushed and pushed it through and worked hard in doing so.
That's awesome. It seems like it takes that level of stubbornness to make something like this really come to fruition.
Yes, it does. And grit.
Yeah. Mm. So this question is no longer valid, I guess, but I am still curious. So what happens now with the Collegiate East route?
It stays the Colorado Trail.
Okay.
Collegiate East and Collegiate West are alternatives in the middle. And people, when they get there, have to decide whether to turn left or turn right.
Got you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it still seemed like a good percentage of Colorado Trail hikers were taking the Collegiate West route. So, but now it's just, I guess, what has changed? Just that the Colorado Trail is also part of the Collegiate West route instead of it just being the CDT?
Well, in all, the CDT and the Colorado Trail share 314 miles, including the 83-mile Collegiate West. Mm-hmm. So that's not an aberration at all. But the U.S. Forest Service came to our organization and said, "Hey, Colorado Trail folks, you are good at maintaining trail. Can you also maintain the portion that we now call the Collegiate West?"
Gotcha. Huh.
And so we said, we studied that real hard because it was a big jump for us, 80 more miles. Mm-hmm. And we said yes. And since then, it's been known as both the Colorado Trail and the Continental Divide National Scenic Trail, just like other portions mm-hmm. are.
It's cool that there's a trail where you can turn left or right and go one way or the other, and both are the actual trail.
Yeah.
You know, one isn't like a blue blaze. Is that correct? Is that the correct use of blue blaze?
Yeah. If you're going off the trail, that would be a blue blaze.
Sure. Yeah, but both are the trail.
I guess it depends on the context. On the AT, if you're going off trail, it's blue blaze. On the, like in the PCT, when you do the alternate route around Crater Lake, I think people just technically consider that the PCT, even though it's really not. Just kind of depends on the culture, it seems.
Hmm. Trying to get the lingo in check.
Yeah, I know. All these little AT Easter eggs.
What's your favorite segment of the trail?
Oh, I like segment 24 the very best.
You had to say the one I didn't get to.
It starts off on the top at the divide and those high altitude roller coasters that are so fun and high altitude flowers. And then it drops down this unbelievable set of switchbacks. I think there are 32. It loses maybe 1,500 feet just on one hillside. And then goes down into this incredible drainage, Elk Creek. And pretty, oh my God, is it pretty in there? And more moose. And then it crosses the Durango-Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad tracks and Animas River before it goes back up to Molas Pass. All just really stellar.
Yeah.
We did that in September. I'm not sure if this is a year-round thing, but I don't know if there were wildflowers or just like the colors of the grass, but the colors in that section, right as you start to descend into the steep portion, are spectacular. Like, those are some of my favorite photos from the entire trail.
Just lovely.
Yeah.
You know, down there in that part of the state, though, the logistics of doing some of those sections, if you put segments together and do them as a section, the logistics get pretty hard with the transportation. So we frequently are asked, you know, what part's the best week-long hike? And the answer is what we were talking about. But the logistics get hard.
Yeah. Yep, don't I know it.
I tried desperately to talk Chance out of doing the trail in sections because I originally started to do that and just realized it was you're going to spend more time in the car than actually hiking the trail.
Yeah, he had the smuggest look on his face the day I came in, and I was like, I hate this. And he was like, I told you.
So what does the future of the Colorado Trail look like? Is it just more of the same? Or?
Well, in part, yes. We're going to keep trying to move off the roads. And that's an environmental thing with the U.S. Forest Service and NEPA studies and all of that approvals. And we're going to try. So when we do move the trail, if we are allowed to, we will be building new trail with volunteers. Tough stuff. Forging new trail is kind of slow, but it's really fun. And we are going to keep working at, like, in the Mount Princeton Hot Springs area is 5 miles of road walking. And that is something we'd sure like to reroute, but we have yet to find that key route that would help us get off those roads.
Is that a funding issue? Is that a land acquisition?
It's private lands.
Yeah.
Yeah, and development. Mm-hmm. And so it's, and it's also, there's a dangerous wash down there that's really a big problem for us. The water comes cascading off this steep cliff, and it brings down lots of rock when it does, and it's very dangerous. And we have to cross that somehow, too. So that's a lot of challenges in these types of things, but we'll keep working at them. And then just sustaining the effort, just keeping the volunteers coming, keeping the funding coming, and connecting with the folks that will help us in those ways, volunteers and donors.
Cool. I have one question that's not on our little notebook. I was wondering if you could tell us what to do if you see a moose. Because I had encountered a moose this summer really up close, and I didn't know what to do. I don't know what precautions to take or...
Cry?
So,
yeah, besides that.
So you should be real, real careful when this happens. When you see a moose, you should get out your camera. That's what you should do.
All right. Cool.
No, moose are pretty dangerous, and they're just big, and they kind of got grouchy attitudes. I think they're kind of fairly easy animal to rile up, and but I don't think we're not hearing any problem of people seeing moose, so I don't think this is happening in any kind of numbers at all. Dangerous encounters aren't happening. So get out your camera and enjoy it. And, but you know, don't go harass the thing.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a mistake.
Yeah.
There was a moose in like downtown Golden. This was, I think, a year or two ago. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I drove by and there was just like a crowd of people standing around this park. And there's a, like, was that a giant horse? Oh my gosh. There's a moose out in the middle of a park in Golden.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know what came of it. Probably well,
The wildlife authorities reintroduced moose to Colorado in I think it was the 1970s. It might have started a little bit earlier than that, but they really kicked the effort in gear in the 70s and 80s. And boy, moose are pretty common. You see quite a few of them in Colorado these days.
I'd never seen one before doing the trail, and now I've seen three.
Yeah.
Just wait till the 18.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Last question before we wrap it up. What's the craziest? So you said you've been doing this for 13 years?
Yes.
What's the craziest story that you've heard?
Ooh,
whether
question.
It be from like a thru hiker or just a strange animal encounter, I guess span the spectrum, but what's the most bizarre story you've heard on trail?
Well, certainly one of them was a guy that completed the Colorado Trail end to end on that unicycle.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a big thing.
Yeah.
And I've got 6 miles of my Colorado Trail are on unicycle.
Wow.
On my own. But that was Waterton Canyon, so that hardly counts. I mean, that was a pretty smooth track for a unicycle. Nothing like this guy was experiencing.
I couldn't do
was
6 feet.
Was he riding it up the hills?
I mean, think of segment 7.
Yeah.
Breckenridge to the top of the 10-mile range and down to Copper. On a unicycle?
Yeah.
I could hardly walk it.
So when we crossed paths with him, he actually was on an uphill and he was carrying it. I'm not sure if he was just, because that happened to be a pretty steep section.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if he was carrying it through the steeper uphills and maybe riding up the flatter ones. I don't know. But he was carrying it.
I always thought that whenever I was like huffing and puffing up a really steep climb and, you know, you hear a little, hello, and there's a bike coming up you and they're riding the bike up.
Yeah.
It's just insane to me.
Yeah,
riding up
hills.
Stood there like clapping every time.
Yeah, you deserve
it. Don't know how.
Yeah.
Another story is there was a family that decided to go through hiking, and the four boys, the youngest was 8, and they pulled off a father and 3 of the boys, youngest being 8 years old, pulled off a through hike one summer with this 8-year-old. And his 10-year-old and 12-year-old brothers all thru-hiked. And Dad was real smart. He went to the grocery store, studied up on calories, and decided to bring olive oil. And he dribbled olive oil on each of the meals that these boys ate, because they're really skinny little boys. And that the main thing was for them not to lose weight during this trip, because that would have ended the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept them from losing weight with olive oil, and they made the whole through hike. Took every Sunday off in some town just to recoup.
So is that the youngest person to have done the Colorado Trail?
I don't know. It might be the youngest, but it's certainly among them.
Yeah.
Does the CTF keep stats on like the number of people that attempt it versus the number that actually complete it?
We don't know that, but I could guess at somewhere around 50%. I think, through hiker-wise, maybe something like 50% of those people who try it throw in the towel at some point, and a lot because of blisters.
Yeah, I think the great thing about it being 485 miles rather than 2,000 something is that you have not as much of a rush to make it through a weather window.
Big
so
weather window, yeah.
If you're not as fast of a hike, or if you're not as in shape as, you know, more extreme hikers, you can take your time on it and not have to worry that you're going to hit with snow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Here's a question for you. If someone was going to hike it in the average time span, I'm assuming it's about a month, what would you propose as the ideal starting date? Because there are a lot of weather considerations to make. As you know, in Colorado, the monsoon season can be rather ornery. It seems like people tend to start on the earlier end, but in my observation, that can present a lot of weather challenges and the fact that you're dealing with thunderstorms almost every single day. So I'm curious to get your take on what you think the ideal start date would be.
Well, if you could predict this coming year's thunderstorms, it would be a lot easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So I would say that any start date between July 1 and September 1 is a pretty darn good choice. Mm-hmm. You want to be done by September 30 at the latest. And you really don't want to start before July 1. And you could push that up by a week, maybe in some years, mm-hmm. but not very much.
Yeah.
So July 1 and September 1, pick a start date. If you like fewer bugs and fewer thunderstorms, you might hike in September alone. But you got to like colder temperatures, shorter days,
mm-hmm.
and a few snowstorms.
Yeah.
Little ones, usually, that don't last very long, but still, not everybody's up for getting snowed on.
Right.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, sleeping at 12,500 feet, I think, is where we slept at the end of 23, it was freezing, and that was the end of August.
Yeah.
It was the coldest night I've had.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Any parting messages that you'd like our listeners to know about where they can go to get involved, or just like anything that you'd like to convey to our audience?
Well, we volunteers build and maintain this trail, so come help us do it. And even if you're not going to do that this coming summer, if you're going to go use the trail, travel the trail, spot some volunteers along the way and pat them on the back. And if they're on a trail crew, ask them for spaghetti dinner that night, and I'll bet you anything they'll feed you. And it can be really memorable to run into trail work volunteers.
Yeah, awesome.
Great.
Well, thank you again
so much.
We really appreciate your time.
Woohoo!
And that was that. Thanks so much again to Bill Manning for his time and shedding some insight on the Colorado Trail. Did you walk out of that interview having any questions that you wished you asked? I do that all the time.
I remember because we had asked about the permits, if there would be permits on the Colorado Trail.
Yeah, he did mention that. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I remember thinking to myself, I wish we were still recording.
Yeah. Yeah, because so off mic, and I don't know, I doubt he would have any issue with this, so I'll check with him before putting this on air, but he did mention that he thinks, you know, that could be in the Colorado Trail's future at mm-hmm. some point. It sounds like, as of right now, it's a pretty manageable traffic rate, but, you know, things change.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, let's get into some Trek propaganda. As you guys know, we've done a lot of the gear overviews from the 2018 Thru-Hiker survey. Today, I want to get into the top sleeping bags. Once upon a time, we could just call it the top sleeping bags, but now we have to add quilts because those are dominating in the thru-hiking world. The top sleeping bags, quilts, and pads. So the top brands amongst all three of these are amongst top sleeping bags and quilts. By far and away, number one is Enlighten Equipment. They're killing it. We don't have to cover Chauncey's experience with EE any more than we already have. Number two is REI. And tie for three is between Kelty and Big Agnes. It's actually kind of surprising to not see Katabatic in there. But
I was just thinking that in my head.
I think it's the price point.
Yeah.
It's a more expensive quilt compared to Enlighten Equipment, but I would also argue you get what you pay for. Not to shit on Enlighten Equipment. I think they make great quilts also. Let's just run through the top sleeping bag models first. Number one was the Kelty Cosmic. I imagine this was the most popular because it's pretty affordable. Actually, don't have the price offhand. We can wait.
Let's look it up.
Yeah. It's on sale right now at REI for $120, which is dirt cheap.
You better put this out before the sale ends.
Yeah, exactly. Number two on this list is the Z-Pax Classic. I think like Enlighten Equipment, you can actually make modifications based on your length, how warm you want it, etc. That's what Jabba used on the PCT. And number three was kind of a tie between the REI Jewel and Magma. Again, I think this is another sleeping bag that is popular because of its price point. I should point out number one and number three have a pretty low loft rating. Actually, let me fact check myself. That's not true. Okay. Mostly just the Kelty Cosmic. I think the Kelty Cosmic is 650 fill power.
It looks kind of big.
600. So, you know, it's certainly not the lightest sleeping bag out there, but again, you know, if you're very pressed in your gear budget, this is going to be a good option for you. If you've got a little bit more money to spend, and generally speaking, I think sleeping bags and quilts are a great place to spend up. I would recommend looking at something with a higher fill power. I'd say like 750 to 800 would be a minimum for something where you're trying to go for like an ultralight-ish pack. To the top quilts, and this is, again, by far and away the most popular model, quilts and sleeping bags included, was the Enlighten Equipment Revelation. This was actually used by 1 in 5 or 20% of Appalachian Trail hikers. And for the second year in a row, this was the most popular model.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just going to start sprinkling these in everywhere.
Let's do it.
What degree quilt would you say I should bring on the AT?
So there's more variance in terms of when you start. If you're starting on the later end, I think you could get away with a slightly warmer sleeping bag or quilt. But generally speaking, and you know, your mileage may vary depending on how warm or cold you sleep, I typically advise people to go in with a 20 degree bag.
Even if I'm a cold sleeper? So I had a 0 degree Enlightened equipment and I was still cold a lot of nights.
So all I can say is the lowest temperatures that I saw on the AT, and it's probably a little bit colder because it's a more damp environment. So I can tell you what the air temperature was. I don't know what the wind chill was. But I think the coldest night that I saw was in the 16 degree range. And I had I had a 15 degree sleeping bag and I was cold as shit. Like getting out to get dressed in the morning. I remember that being one of like the most stark memories that I had the entire trail, was getting like packing up my stuff after that. Cause like, unlike on the PCT, where as soon as the sun hits you, you're a normal person again, but like while it's dark out, it can get really cold. The AT, you're not always saved by the sun for a couple of reasons. One, it's damper, so the sun's not going to save you for that reason. And two, you're in a forest the entire time.
True.
So you're not going to, you know, you'll get glimmers of sunlight, but it's not going to be bright like it is on the PCT. So yeah, maybe then that would be a scenario where you'd want to go a little bit colder, 0, 10 degrees maybe.
Okay.
Again, that's something that you can supplement with your sleep system altogether, whether that's a warmer sleeping pad, you know, sleeping in your down jacket. There are things you can do to supplement your sleeping bag to, you know, ensure that you're able to get through the night. And then lastly are the top sleeping pads. No surprise, this brand dominates every year, is Therm-a-Rest. I won't even mention 2 and 3 just because they had, I think it was like 70% something in that range of all the sleeping pads out there. But the most popular model they had was the Neo Air series, primarily the X-Lite, which is what I use. Chance is not a fan. The Z-Lite is number 2. That's the foam pad. People prefer that, much easier, less squeaky. If you're Chance, it stays underneath you better.
Yeah, it's not that I'm not a fan. I'm just not good at the Neo Air.
Yeah, fair. And then number 3, 15 respondents cited the ProLite series. Okay, I won't go too down the rabbit hole with that. I definitely think you guys should check this article out on the website. As always, Mariposa did a phenomenal job. We will include this in the show notes. Next segment, got some fan mail.
Ooh.
You want to take this one?
Sure. Fan mail says, "Hey, my name is Chris, and I just found your podcast, and this is a plea not to ever stop. I'm 38, married with 4 girls, ages 7, 4, parentheses, twins, and 1, and I work full-time for the sheriff's department. So my opportunity to hike and backpack is now limited. I spent much of my late 20s and early 30s enjoying hiking in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. I miss the mountains, and your podcast allows me to daydream and think about hiking when changing dirty diapers or dealing with bad guys. In the meantime, my wife and I are rediscovering the White Mountains through the eyes of my kids and doing the smaller day hikes with them. So please don't ever stop putting out the podcast, and I will keep listening and reading articles on your website. From Christopher Chudzik."
Looks right to me. Christopher, thank you so much for writing in. If you guys want to get in touch with us, that's podcast@thetrek.co. And a quick correction I actually want to make on something I said earlier in the episode was to treat your down stuff. I think I said DownTech. DownTech is the brand that uses their proprietary treatment, and they partner with other brands. If you're going to buy something to treat your own down, or to, I should say, wash your down, Nickwax is the brand I meant to say.
Nickwax, okay.
Yeah. And to Chance's favorite part of the show.
Woohoo! These are our 5-star reviews. Zach, do you want to do the first one?
Yeah. First, as in the ones that you texted me. There's a lot here.
Whichever one you want. Yeah, I give you options.
Got you. I'll go with this one because it has poop in the title. You know me too well. This is from O'Hanley, and he writes, or he or she writes, top-notch trail recipes and poop ellipses. I'm guessing stories.
Stories.
Let's go with stories. I mean, I freaking love the podcast so much. I think it gives such a great variety of information, jokes, perspectives, and five-star level trail recipes, and also the single greatest poop story ever. So probably validates our guess for the title. Love the hosts, their doggos, and their personal trail stories. Even hearing that Zach may or may not have hiked some sort of long-distance trail on the east. I wonder if you'll start to be lumped into the AT jokes now.
Never.
Yeah, it's not like you'll ever want
to talk about it. It's about time one of us does it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. thanks for all your hard work, Zach and Sean. Thank you so much for writing in, O'Hanley.
The next one is Five Stars So Good by No Trail Name Yet. I love this podcast so much. I listen to it almost as soon as each new episode comes out. It's been a great way to keep myself focused and motivated through the months leading up to my PCT through hike attempt in 2019. The guests are always informative and entertaining to listen to. Also, gotta give props to the Cinnamon Connection for their banter and general good vibes. I hope Chance gets out on the AT next year. Maybe that will inspire Zach to finally give it a shot. Keep up the good work, y'all.
You guys are too much.
Sorry, I had to read that one.
No trail name yet. Thank you so much for writing in. And let's make this the last one.
Okay.
So it's a mouthful. This is from Lauren Isaac, and the title is Excellent Podcast. Been slowly working my way through this one and just finished episode 14 with Data. Really happy to hear a shout out for the Superior Hiking Trail in Minnesota. This one is gorgeous, especially in early fall, and well worth the time. Would love to plug the Bartram Trail as another short, well under 30 through hike experience for any other beginners out there. Zach and Chance are awesome hosts, great delivery and banter, and always keep things light and fun while still being informative and analytical. Y'all both seem like wonderful people and add a ton of charm to the listening experience. The guests they rotate always add plenty of content and color. I especially enjoy the gear reviews. Always useful information to have, and wouldn't mind it as a reoccurring segment. My eyesight's really bad. These phone screenshots are killing me.
Yeah, I was going to say you're struggling in this. Yeah.
Oh, I guess I can blow up the image. Damn it. keep up the great work. Thank you so much, Lauren, for writing in. If you guys want to have your review potentially read on iTunes, you know the drill. Go to iTunes and leave any number of stars, just not 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Yep.
Any other number than that. and the last thing that we have consistently dropped the ball on is a shout out to our Patreon people. I think it's the Chuck Norris Award winners, the $25 per month level. Thank you very much to Sawyer Products, who you guys are already very familiar with, and Travis Smith.
Woohoo, go Travis.
Travis, you rock. Chance had the idea of doing...
We don't tell him enough.
No. You guys all rock, but especially the people who are donating at a Chuck Norris level. I think that's it for today's show.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else you want to add, AT related or otherwise?
Not yet.
What are we about to do now?
Drunk dial!
All right, guys, we got to go drink and call you. That's a bonus episode for those of you who are patrons, by the way. Thanks for listening.
Happy hiking.
I got my Magnum condoms. I got my Wad of Hundreds. I'm ready to plow.